Hello and welcome to the Hive Podcast with me, Natalie Nahai. In this fifth season, I'll be exploring how we can change the ways in which we relate to and structure our existing systems so that we can build towards a more resilient future. From alternative economic models and business practices to our role in and perception of the more than human world, this season will explore how we might design ways of living that both enrich and sustain all forms of life, not just our own. For more information, you can find additional resources and links at natalienahai.com/thehivepodcast. And you can also reach out to me on Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn at Natalie Nahai. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy the show. In today's episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with Professor Graham Miller, Pro Vice Chancellor at the University of Surrey and Executive Dean of the Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences. A member of the Executive Board of the University, Graham also holds a chair in sustainability in business, and his research focuses on the drivers we can use to create a more sustainable tourism industry. Graham holds a UK Sustainable Innovation Fund to create indicators of sustainability for businesses in the camping and caravanning industry, with Plum Data Limited and Professor Xavier Font of the University of Surrey. He has previously conducted research for the European Commission DG Enterprise and Industry to develop indicators of sustainability for tourism destinations across Europe, and he's worked for the UK government through DEFRA to create a roadmap for changing consumer behaviour that can generate greater demand for a more sustainable tourism industry in the UK. Now, given that the tourism industry and travel in general was so hard hit by the pandemic in the last 12 months, I thought this would be a really good place to start by addressing how we might begin to rebuild the system of travel, the ways in which we take our leisure and explore the world to create a sustainable, greener, fairer future. Graham, thank you so much for joining me in conversation today. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you.
You're very welcome.
So I'd like to start by asking you the question that I offer all my guests at the beginning of the conversation, which is to know from your perspective what you think is happening in the global human psyche right now.
Wow, that's a big question to kick off with. Well, waking up and reading the news overnight about what's happening in the US and then what's happening in the UK... There seems to be some sort of race to see who's got the most dysfunctional government, doesn't there? But what's happening in the global psyche? It feels like there's a battle of individualism versus collectivism, doesn't it? And it feels like we've got competing worldviews very obviously in view at the moment. And we've got some parts of the world that are able to look at a problem and think that the solution lies in joining together and a collectivist response to that. And that would typically be seen in an Asian solution to a problem. And we see that with first with Wuhan, when the city was closed down and all of us in the West, we looked at that and we thought, crikey, how on earth can you close down a city? How can people cooperate with that, that subjugation of their rights to freedom and et cetera, et cetera? And yet it worked. Yeah. And they've been largely free of COVID for a long period of time. And in the West, we tried to take a somewhat, well, in the UK, tried to take a collectivist approach and politicians appealing to, you know, back to sort of David Cameron's, we're all in this together, we all need to pull together, we all need to work together. And that worked for a bit, to some extent, and then you start to see that fraying at the edges and the individualism of the UK, meaning that that hasn't worked as perfectly as we would like it to. And then you extend that out and you look in the US, where obviously sort of we get a biased view of what's happening and we get the extremist perspective of what's happening. But it looks like that individualism is more extreme and people won't subjugate their individual rights because going and getting their hair cut is more important to them than protecting their neighbour from COVID. And so you see this this continuum of response from entirely individualistic at one end and entirely collectivist at the other end. And we can see as a consequence which is the more effective in dealing with these common threats. And from that, you can then extrapolate to, well, how would we deal with climate change? How would we deal with biodiversity? How would we deal with equality of opportunity within a country, across a range of people, across the world? And so COVID has given us an interesting, I mean, it's been the most extraordinary social science experiment into how we might deal with some of these other common problems that are facing us. It's been an interesting insight into some of those other common problems we face.
And it's fascinating you pulling on the thread of personality and the ways in which we oriented societies. So I live in Barcelona, and the approach here was much more, so far, has been much more pro-social. Yeah. So a lot more people are wearing masks. People are generally pulling together really well. And it's quite different in flavour than the response that we saw in the UK. And I have to say, I feel a lot more comfortable being in a city where people seem to be willing to comply for the good of the whole. I mean, I say that it's not perfect. People are also going and having big family Christmases, which they weren't meant to do. And we'll see that reflected in the figures, I imagine. But in the UK, I wonder if a better approach, more effective approach, might have been to appeal to people's individualism and say, look, if you do this, if you take this mask off or you go and meet with friends, when you need care from the NHS, you won't be able to access it because we'll be clogged up working with other people around the clock. Do you think that there are ways in which we can appeal to a culture's kind of tendencies towards individualism to get people motivated to take collectivist action?
Yeah, and that has to be the way forward, doesn't it? We did a lot of research a number of years ago. I mean, all my research has largely been in the travel and tourism industry and looking how tourism can be a force for good. So how can we derive benefit from a tourism industry? And we looked at the concept of social tourism. So this is enabling people who otherwise wouldn't be able to go on holiday to go on holiday, and looking at what some of the benefits that come from this form of tourism is. And one of my colleagues, who is a PhD student of mine, subsequently became a colleague, is Belgian, and looked at this concept from a European perspective and how there was this just sort of natural view, and she put it down to the ethics that people are brought up with in Belgium, and so it's sort of a more Northern European but Western European perspective, that it is part of our collective responsibilities to help other people. And so the argument you would use to advocate for social tourism in Belgium was different than the one when she moved to the UK and made this very sort of moral argument of, well, look, it's of benefit to people. So why wouldn't we do this? Whereas in the UK, you need a much more instrumental argument, which is the people who go on this holiday. So if you take single mums, let's say, as one of the groups that we looked at, and said, well, if you give them a holiday, they otherwise wouldn't be able to go on a holiday. So let's, through charity, let's enable them to go on holiday. What are the benefits to society of single mums feeling more incorporated into society? What are the benefits to their children of not feeling so excluded from society? Does this reduce their reliance on prescription medication? Does it reduce the incidence of depression in their lives? Does it make them more functioning adults? More likely to get a job, less of a drain on the welfare state, those kind of things. And it was a much more instrumental argument as to why you would support somebody to be able to go on holiday. And I think there is something in that about, there's no right or wrong. I mean, I have my views of how I would like society to be ordered. But, you know, if I step back from that and say there's no right or wrong here, a European or an American or an Asian or a British approach is not wrong, right or wrong. What we've got to do, though, is understand how people think and then design our solutions that pull on those levers. So if you've got an individualistic society, then clearly you need to incentivize people along those lines. And so the research we did on social tourism was collecting the evidence that actually putting people, enabling single mums to go on holiday does reduce the cost to society because they're more engaged with the community. They're more likely to be economically productive, less require less support from the welfare state. And so the arguments and the evidence you collect is different for the different just the different orientations of people.
Yeah, it does make my heart sad actually to hear that we need that kind of argument to be persuaded to take that sort of action. I wonder if through taking these sorts of arguments and measures, it then creates a situation which people come to value through firsthand experience, the more emotive reasons why you might want to do it. So kindness to other people, that kind of can sneak in through the back door and shape society a little bit by bit.
Well, it's an interesting question, Natalie. I mean, I used to teach business ethics and to my students and sort of make the case or give a whole raft of reasons as to why we might try to adopt a more ethical approach to business, and would always start with the moral argument. And, you know, I could see sort of eyes rolling as, oh my God, here he goes again. We're back to Aristotle. Why did we start 3,000 years ago? And then would sort of work through to those more business reasons about that your staff will be more productive, you get better PR with your customers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think all those arguments will work and will speak to different peoples in different ways. But I never wanted to just do the business reasons for why you should adopt a more ethical approach to business and ignore the moral reasons, because that, and we may come on to that, but that feels wrong to me, that we would just exclude morality and ethics from the argument and it purely be on the basis of sort of pounds, shillings and pence. And if you can make it pay, then let's be ethical. But if you can't, then don't. That feels wrong to me.
Yeah, and it also feels like reinforcing the system that's kind of allowed us to get into a position where productivity is the be-all and end-all, even if it's not sustainable. I'm curious to ask, I was going to ask this at the beginning, but we went off into such an interesting direction that I didn't want to stem the flow. But your work in sustainability and business, I want to know what attracted you to this field, because obviously it's a very hot topic right now, but I know from experience with my mum's generation, there are a lot of people who were very passionate about this that just didn't get the amplification they needed back in the 60s, 70s and into the 80s that could have averted a lot of the crises we're seeing now. So what attracted you to sustainability and business?
So I come from a sort of a business orientation, studied economics, ended up doing business. And business is such a powerful part of our world, such a powerful force in the world. And then we've got these enormous social environmental problems. And it just feels to me that if business is not part of that solution, then we make the job of fixing these social and environmental problems so much harder. So I'm not quite old enough to have been to the first Rio Earth Summit, but I went to Rio Plus 20, the Earth Summit, and there was a lot of criticism of Rio Plus 20 for the engagement of industry in that, and because the initial Rio Earth Summit was just governments and NGOs, so the charitable sector, and then the subsequent one, industry was invited, and there was a lot of sort of criticism that, well, what's business got to do? Business causes the problem, you know, it's for government to solve the problem, and that felt to me entirely the wrong way of thinking about it. And I'm pleased that business has become more involved in the solution, because they're certainly involved in the problem. So why wouldn't you have business involved in the solution? And we see companies doing such terrible things. We see corporate manslaughter. We see lots of things that are not ethical. Sweatshops. We see fast foods. We see plastics in the food chain. And so we see business doing lots of bad things. And yet, we see companies doing some really good things as well, and really driving faster than governments are able to, driving faster than charities are able to. And you see companies on this transition. I was looking at GM, General Motors, just yesterday, and their commitment to zero carbon. And you know, General Motors was a car company that famously said, and I'll get the quote wrong, I couldn't find the original quote, so hopefully nobody at General Motors is going to sue me, but way back when safety glass was originally introduced into windshields in cars, General Motors were one of a number of car companies that didn't do that, had non-safety glass in their windshields. And so people, there were accidents and the glass was shattering and, you know, and people were dying from that. And General Motors famously said that it's not our job to save lives. We build cars. We don't, it's not our job to save lives. And so you look at a company like that that's been on that transition from, you know, people, we build a product. If people die in it, that's down to them. Through to now, where they've got something like zero accident, zero congestion, zero carbon by 2040. And you think, well, that's an incredible transition for a company. And you can see them becoming potentially a real force for good in the challenges that confront us as a society. And so that's part of the attraction for me, is when we get companies lined up properly, they can run a lot faster and they can make a lot more progress than governments are able to. Mm. And so that's the attraction to me.
Mm. And it's exciting when that pressure builds to a certain point where corporate reputation is on the line and they have to do good by their customers and say, okay, well, we're gonna lead in this particular direction. I also want to ask a little bit more about some of the data-driven approaches to sustainability that you have helped to create and that your work contributes to, because you're also the lead judge for the Tourism for Tomorrow Awards. I'm really curious to hear, what are some of the most exciting breakthroughs in sustainability that you've seen that you kind of really attend to and you think, oh, that's actually quite an extraordinary breakthrough?
Yeah, so the Tourism for Tomorrow Awards, I mean, unfortunately, they've stopped the awards at the moment. I do hope that they resuscitate the awards. Mm. The Tourism for Tomorrow Awards have been absolutely fantastic, and I was so proud. I was involved with them. I was 5 years as a judge and then another 5 years as the lead judge, so really got to put my stamp on those. And again, an interesting transition through the decade that I was involved with those awards. When I first became involved, there was lots of fairly small-scale initiatives. Lots of sort of eco resorts in the Serengeti, massive passion, massive enthusiasm, you know, determination, really sort of sticking your face to the wind and, you know, I am going to make this place sustainable, that absolute belligerence from these fantastic people. And they were amazing examples. The dull academic in me looked at those and thought, well, they're fantastic, but how many people in the world have got the determination and the belligerence to convert their business in the way that these award winners are doing? Mm. And actually what we need is to appeal to the people who are not the zealots. We need to appeal to much more normal, much more typical people who are not against sustainability, but they'll do it if they can see a reason for it. If there is a bit more sort of pounds, shillings and pence kind of argument. And so when I became lead judge, I was really trying to pivot the awards much more towards examples of companies that were using data to create a rational argument for sustainability, because that to me felt more sustainable, that had more longevity to it and was more scalable than those individual incredible people. But the world doesn't have enough time to breed a generation of people who are going to be like that. We've got to come down the pyramid, if you like, and try to appeal more to the base of people and get bigger companies to be more sustainable. So that was where I think some of the real progress came. And so started looking at some of the airlines, what they were doing, looking at big destinations, how they were trying to use data to be more sustainable. And so you get somewhere like Thompson Okanagan Valley in Canada, in Western Canada, in Alberta. So they have all their MasterCard data. Everybody who goes in, they spend their money, you know, as we spend money everywhere, but they were able to get hold of the MasterCard data. Then they had the telephone masts from Telus, so they knew where people were travelling because their mobile phones were pinging every, you know, kilometre as they went past a telephone mast. And then they had Facebook data, so they would put an ad out on Facebook, they would see where people were replying to them from. And so the collection of that set of data allows you to know where people are going, where they've come from, what ads and stimuli have they responded to, and what are they spending. And so if your aim is to reduce the destination that people are travelling from, so reduce their carbon footprint, reduce the miles that they drive, and yet maintain spending and maybe try to direct spending into more sustainable elements of the of the destination or of the product than others, then the triangulation or the merging and the analysis of all those data allows you to think, well, look, we can focus on people from just over the border as opposed to people from Florida, or we can approach, we can target this group of people rather than people from New Zealand. And so you can really try to think about if we're trying to limit, which are the variables we're trying to limit and which are the variables we're trying to maximise, and then try to have a much more data-driven approach to this. So probably a better example, we did this, one of my PhD students, we did this in Cyprus. He was a Cypriot student. So Cyprus got very severe water shortages. So gallon of water is the short resource there. And yet all of their tourism had been about maximising spend in Cyprus. And that was sort of lending them towards focusing on high-end tourism. The problem with high-end tourism is those tourists are really demanding. And what they're demanding is high-end products. Now, if those high-end products have got high water requirements to them, then you're having to spend a lot of your scarce resource to generate the product to serve those tourists. So you might be earning a lot of money, but you're spending a lot of money and you're spending a scarce resource as well. So when you factor in water with earnings, so the question then becomes, how do we generate the most amount of earnings from tourism per gallon of water? You end up with a completely different answer than how do we just generate the most amount of tourism revenue here? And so the answer actually lies in, you need more backpacker charter package tourists who everybody is moving away from because it's the cheap end of the market, it's the bucket and spade end of the market, it's not the sexy, glamorous, high-end tourism. But those people ended up having products that were much less water intensive than the high-end tourists. And so you end up retaining more of the benefit. And it's the, you know, it's the challenge of turnover is for vanity, profits are for sanity argument that every retailer will tell you, don't get drawn into the vanity of chasing high sales. You want high profits. And that's what I think the tourism industry needs to do. And that's what a data-driven approach to tourism will allow you to really think about, what are you trying to maximise, rather than just this headline figure of, we had more tourists last year, fantastic, but it cost you more money to get those more tourists. That was a false thing to pursue, wasn't it?
It seems like it really helps to strip out some of the biases we might have and the flaws in our judgment, to be able to have something to really work off that's going to give the results that we want across the board, and also to value the things that maybe we don't attach, at least immediately, a financial value to.
Yeah, and it just leads you down the wrong line, I think, Natalie, because I did some work last year with Botswana. And so we were looking at, so Botswana, like many countries, is determinedly trying to increase the number of tourists coming into the country, and yet suffering, this is pre-COVID, suffering with capacity limits and the whole sort of, as you will know very well, living in Barcelona, too many tourists coming in. And so you look at Botswana, and I compared it with Namibia, with Kenya, with South Africa, with other countries. So you think, well, they should perform similarly to Botswana. But Botswana has a very limited economy. So tourists come in, and almost everything that serves the needs of the tourists has to be imported. So most of the money bounces straight back out again. So they get left with very little residual value. Whereas somewhere like Kenya has got a much more developed, a much more rounded economy, so they're able to keep more of the benefits of tourism within the country. And South Africa certainly does. Even Namibia certainly does. And so instead of Botswana chasing more and more tourists, what it should be doing is developing its non-tourism industry. It should be developing business, developing its farmers to provide the food for the hotels that the tourists are going to eat. It should be developing a cotton industry, let's say, to develop the bed sheets that serve the hotels that the tourists sleep in. And if it developed its non-tourism industry, it would make its tourism industry and the benefit to the country. You know, and this is not a criticism of Botswana because everybody does this, but we think in industrial sectors rather than looking at the connections between those industrial sectors. And so you end up following the wrong policy. So Botswana is pursuing more and more tourists. It should limit the number of tourists it's got, then it doesn't incur capacity constraints. But try to develop the supply chains and think about making sure that it can serve the needs of the tourists without having to rely on imports. I mean, Japan is another really good example of this, of just chasing growth. And it's got to a situation where Kyoto is completely overrun by tourists. Mm. But it's not benefiting as much for every tourist that it brings in as it did previously, because it's just pursuing these incredible growth targets to go from, I think it was 15 million, it's at 30 million now, and it has ambitions to get to 60 million. But every extra tourist it brings in, it benefits disproportionately less from it.
Mm.
So the pursuit of growth is the wrong objective. It should be pursuing quality and retention of benefit rather than growth.
I think that's a mindset that's quite tricky to get people to come on board with, especially given how so many of us are kind of locked into this perpetual cycle of more. On the one hand, COVID has been a very interesting trial in terms of the city centre here, because obviously we don't have hordes of people blocking the streets, and indirectly, you know, it's had an impact, a knock-on effect on the historic centres of the city. So a lot of touristic shops that sell, you know, cheap plastic trinkets and the likes, they've all shut down. Yes. But actually, those are areas that were devoid of resources for local people. You know, there weren't enough pharmacies, there weren't enough food stalls, etc. In the same breath, it's lost so much of its vibrancy. Are there examples of countries or cities that you've come across that have managed to find a balance, that have taken effective measures to welcome more responsible tourism while mitigating its downsides?
Well, this is what's going to be interesting, isn't it, from COVID. Again, this is sort of a big social experiment as to what sort of future do we want. Mm. And so, you know, Barcelona is a great example of a place that was famously overrun with tourists. We've talked about Kyoto and Amsterdam and Venice and other places. So now it's had an experience of what no tourism looks like. Is it still as keen on the idea of no tourism, or it's given it a greater experience of what no tourism looks like, and so probably better able to judge where on that balance of tourism so where do we want to say, right, this feels like about the right amount of tourists. I think I'm interested in how it's possible for destinations to escape from that growth orientation and from the investment that's been made in mass tourism. Mm. So you've got somewhere like Venice, where you've got the cruise ships coming in, and everybody recognised, okay, Venice had really overcooked it, too many tourists coming in. But with such massive investment into the infrastructure in Venice, there's going to be a huge drive to just restart that whole industry again. I mean, the cruise industry has got to get people going back on cruises again, because you've got these billion-dollar cruise ships that are going to require tourists back on them again. It's going to be interesting as to whether people want to go back on those, but at some point, at some price point, people will, and they will fill them back up again. I think what will be interesting is whether there's more of a drive towards smaller destinations, people feeling less comfortable in big cities, big resorts, big cruise ships surrounded by thousands of other people. Will people have more interest in smaller destinations where we've got more community involvement? Because those are the places where you can get stronger local governance who are able to resist the companies that want to come in, because a big cruise ship won't want to come into a small destination. It's not big enough for it to feed its need. The big hotel chains won't want to come into a small destination. So a small local council, a small local government can't resist
Carnival cruises coming in, or a Hilton coming in, or an Airbnb coming in. They're just not, you know, it's an unfair fight. This is David and Goliath, isn't it? Mm. But if you've got smaller companies wanting to come in, then the local governance structure is able to cope with that. And therefore, you're more likely to get tourism on terms that the local population feels are acceptable, rather than in a place like Venice, where, you know, it's fairly obvious that it's not on the terms that the local population feel is acceptable, because they're not able to stand up to these big companies that are coming in. And, you know, Barcelona in a lot of ways is the leading light, because you've elected a mayor who, she was determinedly against the tourism industry and taking on those companies and trying to resist that, whereas I think a lot of other places are just, you know, are not able to do that. So it will be interesting as to whether we see a shift towards smaller destinations. The price of aviation is certainly going to go up, so that will likely make people travel less, travel shorter distances, maybe travel differently. So maybe we do revert more to trains and probably cars. People will initially at least feel more comfortable driving in their private cars. So that again naturally reduces the distance that people will be traveling on their holidays. And maybe we do become more regional again. I think we will travel differently. There's huge incentive for the industry to get it back exactly the way it was before, because of all the massive investment that's made. And those become stranded assets if they can't get the cruise ships full, the hotels full, the resorts full again. So they will need to discount and discount and discount until they get to a point where they are full. But I think there will be a cautiousness of tourists and an aversion to big crowded spaces for a little while. And whether that's enough of an opportunity for those smaller destinations to really capture the interests of people and make people realise you don't need to go to Barcelona. There's other places around Barcelona which are fantastic to visit, and you can have a holiday that's at least as good and arguably a lot better by not going to Barcelona and going to some of these other places instead. And whether that just gets people thinking about travelling in a different way than we were before. We were on that conveyor belt, weren't we? And we weren't stopping to think. And maybe this is an opportunity where we can stop to think, try something different and think, oh, this is a different kind of tourism. I quite like this. Staying closer to home. You know, I can have all of the experience in Europe that I was previously travelling to Thailand or the Caribbean for. You know, Europe's beaches are as good as any beaches in the world. You don't need to travel all the way to Thailand to get a great beach to sit on.
No, but we might need visas to get into Europe just as we would for Thailand.
That's true.
Yeah, that's brutal. No, it is fascinating what you're saying about the shifts we might see in behaviours in terms of travel. And also this idea of regionality. I for one, absolutely love taking trains. And I'm wondering if, I mean, it would also be wonderful and exciting if some of the larger companies, say the cruise liners, can find alternative ways to make use of the sitting assets that they have, the stranded assets. So I think that's one of the things that we're going to have to do is find ways to repurpose, you know, everything from office blocks to hotels, etc., to reskilling populations. Like the whole system is in need of a rethink.
Yep.
And I'm wondering in terms of the disruption to air travel, for instance, and the fact that it's probably going to go up. Do you see any opportunities of maybe extreme ways that we could build out of this crisis? Or do you think it's going to be more of a stumble upon iterative type of step-by-step approach?
Yeah, it is interesting, isn't it? What changes will stick out of all of this. So we're all sort of coming up on 12 months now, aren't we, of having been locked down and working from our kitchen tables and working at home. It feels very unlikely that we go back completely to how we were before, and that some of this will stick. And yet, now we've perhaps got a better sense of the things that work well and the things that we can't do remotely. In the other part of my job of trying to run a university, there are things I can do more effectively at home because I get bothered a little bit less by people. The people that sort of come into and just sort of just passing my office and use the opportunity to prosecute their case for something in some way. So I'm able to be a little bit more effective on that. But then the you miss the creativity, you miss the innovation, you miss the opportunity to all sit around a table and really bash out an idea. And that's difficult to do when everybody's on a Teams call. And so I think there are some industries that will say, look, this just hasn't worked at all. We can't be creative when we're all over the world. And then other people for whom it works perfectly well, and in some tasks it worked perfectly well. And you can extrapolate from that to tourism as well, that, you know, maybe people have taken this opportunity to just reappraise, well, do I need to be going to New York for a long weekend to go shopping? Do I need to spend every weekend going into the shops? Can I do all that at home? Local beaches, local walks, you know, re-engaging with the family. All those things are there. There's a prize there to be had. And we've all had an experience of it now. Some people may think, oh my God, the last thing I want is more time with my family. I was ambivalent about the family before, but now I've really made my mind up. I don't want to be with the family anymore. And of course, that's not my case. Again, we've all now had a bit of a taste of something different. And that's always tourism's argument and slight defence in the face of criticism about you're encouraging people to travel all the way around the world, you know, and the polar tourism and Arctic tourism and taking tourists out to fragile places in the world. And look at the damage you're doing in doing that. And tourism's defence has always been, but this gives people an exposure to a different way of life. It gives people an exposure to what the fragility of nature and the importance of protecting it. And so now when you go back home again, now you need to make sure that you do your recycling, because you can see a connection between you recycling and the plastic in the ocean and the beauty of a whale that you saw while you were on holiday, for example, or, you know, the dolphins that you saw or whatever it might be. And so that was always tourism's defence. And that's always been difficult to prove, and we've looked at that as to whether I did some work for DEFRA, Department for the Environment, many years ago about the sort of pathways to sustainability and whether that foot-in-door strategy is the sort of vernacular term for, do we just get our foot in the door of people's environmental interests with tourism? We showed them something amazing. They weren't previously bothered about the environment, but now you've captured their attention, and when they come home, they're more likely to change their behaviour, maybe walk to the local shops, recycle a little bit more, and just think a little bit more. And so that's the opportunity that's been presented to us, and the challenge will be to see how much of that sticks, won't it?
One of the main issues, again, maybe it kind of connects back into the beginning of our conversation around finding the most persuasive argument depending on the culture or the people you're trying to reach. But in that vein, there's also something about the way in which we perceive and value what's immediate and close to us, the value of the familiar. And I know that with the lockdown, so many more people turn to, you know, the birds in their local park or in their garden, if they had a garden. And it was this noticing, this new way of looking with more of a fresh perspective, that which is already around us. So this kind of the valuing of the beauty and the nature that we have in close proximity, as opposed to fantasizing about the far off shore or whatever it might be. And I wonder if that's also going to change the way in which we value how businesses run more broadly. Because I know that, you know, my professional work as a public speaker and a facilitator, in recent years, I've heard a lot more conversation around the importance more generally of ethics and values within business, whatever the industry, from tourism and beyond, both within organisations and then also interactions with the customers, with publics. Are you seeing a greater willingness for business leaders to engage with questions of ethics and values now?
Yeah, I think there's always been that, hasn't there? There's always been leaders who are focused on ethics and values. And, you know, to some extent, the question
should be the other way around. Is so why haven't we seen business leaders talking about ethics and values? Because this is inescapable. Business is part of society. It shouldn't be sort of apart from society in some ways. And, you know, you can go back to, I was like Naomi Klein's book, No Logo, which talked about the vulnerability of companies like Nike and some of the airlines. And I mean, she was writing in a pre-social media age. And so it's only exacerbated now. But the vulnerability of these vast companies that are built largely on the strength of their brand, because a Nike t-shirt is no different from a no brand t-shirt. But it sells for $50 more because it's got this great brand investment. And so the vulnerability of that to any negative PR and any negative publicity that comes from sort of the sweatshops or anything like that. So that's always been there. You're right that you see the adverts on telly, you see the way that companies are promoting themselves now. It looks like values are becoming more prominent in the way that they're presenting themselves. Now, is that more than just talk? I think so. I think in most cases that it is more than just talk, because social media has certainly created a much higher risk of being caught out, and somebody being able to promote that, and then that catching fire, and suddenly then, you know, really unable to get your head back down below the parapet again. Is it enough that we've just got cute adverts on TV with sort of you know, warm, glowy feelings about the company? Well, clearly not, and that's where we need to move much more towards the assessment. And again, it's the dull academic side of things, but not just academic, but it is still dull. But the monitoring, the assessment, the reporting, the evaluation of impacts, and putting the evaluation of the impact of a company on the same footing as the evaluation of the profit of the company. And so seeing reporting of sustainability in company reports is a really important development. And that sustainability, the annual sustainability report, not being a separate report, but it being included within the overall annual report. And this really came to me a number of years ago, and I was listening to a very eminent, august CEO talking about his company's performance. And he talked, you know, very much about the bottom line, how much they'd earned, what they'd produced for their shareholders, how successful they'd been, rah, 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 fantastic. And then I asked him a question about their sustainability, and he talked all about the effort they were making. And there was no ability to give me an answer in terms of the output of what had they achieved. And I thought, if you were presenting to your shareholders your company financial reports and talked only about how hard you'd worked, but didn't talk about the profit you'd produced, you'd get thrown out. You'd get laughed out as being, you know, being an incompetent CEO. What are you doing? I don't care how hard you've worked. Tell me how much money you've made. So why does my question about how successful have you been at reducing your water impact or your climate, your carbon emissions, get an answer in terms of the input variables rather than the output? And that's the change that needs to happen. We need to get CEOs as comfortable talking about their carbon emissions and understanding how they reduce their carbon emissions as they are talking about their financial bottom line. And it's that education of CEOs, and, you know, it is generational coming through, but it's having them take it seriously enough to educate themselves about carbon, about biodiversity, about water, about equality. You know, they should just be able to spit out, just tell me what's your male-female balance. Tell me what's the difference in earnings ratio. Tell me the intergenerational difference between youth and more senior employees. Have you got everybody on the same wages? Don't tell me about all the initiatives you've got for being equal opportunities employers. And we see this with Black Lives Matters, that real shift, and this has been a sort of a learning for me as well with Black Lives Matters, that we've always treated people equally,
And I think the change that's come now is I'm not interested about whether you treat people equally. I want to see the evidence that people are being treated equally. And the outcome is that people are equal, not how we're treating them and we're an equal opportunities employer, but that you end up with no discrimination and no differentiation in the way that that people are paid or treated at work. And so that really shift from an input to an output, I think, is part of the development. But certainly values is an important part of that. But I'm to some extent more interested in, so what? What does that actually end up producing for us?
I wonder if it's also reflected in some of the conversations away from corporate social responsibility towards ESG, so environment, social and corporate governance, that now people are actually talking about this much more proficiently and attaching it in some cases to an output which is measurable, which you can track over time.
So corporate responsibility is one of the, so one of my, again, sorry, I give academics a bad sort of bad rap in this, but I have a favourite academic article, and probably not many people have a favourite academic article, but I do, which is Garrett Hardin's The Tragedy of the Commons, which, you know, sort of slipped into more sort of common reading, I guess, now. But Hardin talks about responsibility being a bankrupt quid pro quo, an attempt to get something for nothing, which is a fantastic line. I wish I was sufficiently poetic to be able to write something like that. But a bankrupt quid pro quo, an attempt to get something for nothing. Because it asks, what does it mean when a company behaves responsibly? It's getting positive PR, it's saying we're a responsible company, but what's the world getting from that? And does the world really need what that company is giving in saying it's being responsible? And it's not obvious that within a CSR framework that what the company is doing to claim to be responsible is necessarily what the world needs from that company. And so that's why sustainability is so contextual. What the company gives has to fit in with what the context of that company, the place in which it operates, the impacts it has, what the world needs, what that destination needs. So I like the idea much more of corporate relevance. Show me as a company why the world needs you. Why should you exist? And this takes you back to social contracts and Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and, you know, back to a different time in a political context. But that idea of a social contract between society and a company. Companies should have a mandate from society to exist. And in order to get that mandate, they have to show that they can provide something that's useful and important to the world. And so some of the fantastic companies that I know, Wilderness Safaris, who operate throughout Africa, it's an amazing company called Global Himalayan Expeditions. They operate, obviously, in the Himalayas in India. What do the places in which we operate, what do they need? How can our company best serve those? And then how can we do that through very corporate means? These are companies, these are profit-driven companies. They're not NGOs, they're not charities. But they've designed their company to deliver a social mission and a profitable mission. And that, to me, is corporate social relevance. And that's a much more powerful and, I think, a much more future-oriented concept or way of thinking about the role of companies than corporate social responsibility, which is, I say, at its worst, is greenwashing and tokenistic.
Brilliant. I really like that idea. So we're coming close to time, and I have just a few more questions, shorter ones to ask you. The first is, what is a book that you would recommend that everybody reads and why?
Well, I've just spent some of lockdown reading A Gentleman in Moscow, which is Amor Towles, which I would say was a fantastic book. It's during the Russian Revolution and being locked down in his, or under house arrest in a hotel in Moscow. And so that's a good book for lockdown reading, I would say. But it's a wonderful book because he's locked down in this hotel for years and years and years. And it shows how we can thrive in a much smaller environment, and how you learn to take pleasures from the smaller things, from the more immediate things, and how we can still derive a satisfying life
even when we're, in his case, under house arrest in a single building. And so that was quite a positive book to read.
Wonderful.
I mean, more academically, this period has been a real bonanza period for people writing. And so there's been a huge amount of material come out, and obviously podcasts like yours and other podcasts and other material that's been available, there has been a real bonanza of fantastic thinking that's come out through this period. So I think it's one of those things where you've just got to sort of run around and get your feet wet and enjoy all that's been written.
And if I were to ask you what you'd like your legacy to be, how might you start to answer that?
Oh, my legacy, gosh. I am very positive that things are changing. So Johan Rockström, who's at the Stockholm Resilience Institute, he was the author of the planetary boundaries concept, and he came to speak at the University of Surrey, where I work, last year, and talked about the idea that actually from initial problem identification through to it really beginning to permeate policy, consumer actions, corporate actions, is a 25-year period. And so whilst initially you think, well, that's a bit depressing, really. It takes us 20 years to get this into our thick heads that we've got to do some change. And he sort of drew the distinction between, you know, we're very good at responding to a problem when we see, you know, the advancing army coming over the hills. We can quickly mobilise our defences. And I guess we've done that with COVID, haven't we? Within a 12-month period, we've got vaccines going. And here's a clear, tangible problem. But he said that within the climate change arena, because this is intangible, it's future oriented, it's distant, there's contested science, that this is a 25-year period, he thought, to get these change. And initially you think, oh, that's quite depressing, but I did my PhD on this topic in the year 2000. So that's coming, that's 20 years 21 years now, which you know, makes me feel really old. But then you think, actually, I can see change. I can see companies, and the companies that I initially went to talk to 20 years ago that threw me out of their office and said, we have no interest in sustainability. Mm. And now the ones coming back who are asking me for advice and asking me for help on how do we become more sustainable and actually advancing beyond my thinking even and beyond, you know, in impressing me with their behaviour. So I do think that there's something to that 25 years, and it feels like it's coming up to this real change, and whether COVID can be the catalyst for this, whether people like Greta Thunberg, you know, again become the catalyst for this, whether it's just getting into people's heads that we need to change, and the money markets, the insurance markets, the investors, consumers, governments, everybody is just getting to understand, crikey, we've got to do something about this. And so for me, if my legacy is, well, I was one of those people, and I'll take no more claim for it than just being one of many, many people, but one of those people that was part of highlighting this as a problem and highlighting a pathway to a solution, then I'll be very proud if we can see some change that does avert the worst of climate change, the worst of biodiversity, helps to make society a fairer place.
And maybe in that context or on that note then, what question might you like people to dwell with at this moment?
I think it is, what can you do to make the world a fairer place? You know, it's a danger that becomes a little bit cheesy, and but really thinking about, well, what contribution are you making, and are you making the world a better place or not? And we all have to balance different aspects of our life, and we've all got our preferences, and some people can't imagine not eating meat. Okay, well then what else can you do? Can you walk to work? Can you turn down your thermostat? Can you have, you know, one less holiday a year? So those kind of things, and it's that balancing within our lives, but in order to try to reduce the impact that we're having on the world. So just asking that question of what are you doing to make the world a fairer, better place, I think leads us to some interesting thinking.
And finally, maybe you've already spoken to this in various different ways, but what vision of the world are you holding for others?
The whole concept of sustainability is the way that I see sustainability is about giving people opportunity. You have no opportunity for development if you're dead. So we have to solve the problem of infant mortality. We have to solve the problem of famine. We have to solve the problem of lack of food in the world. So we have basic health requirements in order to be able to give people opportunities. Sustainability is then trying to have people make the best of those opportunities, because we need everybody thinking about how to make the world better. And if people haven't got, they've died as a child, they haven't got education, if girls aren't educated, given a fair opportunity, then we're just losing great segments of the population at every turn who are potentially far more intelligent than I am, far better placed to come up with solutions than I am. But I'm the one here able to make those, you know, I'm the one given responsibility to try to make the world better because of all the opportunity that I've inherited from being a white middle-aged man in the UK. Well, you know, there'll be people far smarter than me in other parts of the world that don't get to solve problems because they've not got the opportunity that I do. So having a world that's fairer, having a world that allows other people in the world to be able to help solve problems is the kind of society. We've got enough money in the world, we've got enough food in the world, it's just unfairly distributed. Final thought I'll leave you. So John Rawls was the American philosopher who talked about laying a veil of ignorance over every social dilemma, and I've always liked that idea. And Rawls's thought experiment was that if we didn't know if we were going to be Jeff Bezos at one end or the indentured labourer picking the coffee beans in Côte d'Ivoire at the other end, would we say, what kind of global system, capitalistic system would we design? We wouldn't design the system that we've got because there'd be a risk that we'd be the slave labourer in Côte d'Ivoire. We might get lucky, we might be Jeff Bezos, but the odds are stacked in the favour of being the slave labourer in Côte d'Ivoire. And so if we lay this veil of ignorance over a problem, we would just naturally, pragmatically design a fairer system for it. So if we can take our investment out of looking at a problem, we would have a fairer society. And I think that's probably what we all need to do, is take our positionality out of it a little bit more and think, well, what would a fairer world look like?
Thank you for listening to the Hive podcast with me, Natalie Nahai. To find out more about today's guest and the topics we explored, you can visit the show notes page at natalienahai.com/thehivepodcast. And if you enjoyed the show, please do give it a rating or review, as it helps to reach new ears. My thanks to Caro C for producing. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to sharing more with you in the next episode.